Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's your turn. Tell us about the story you picked.
I picked a story by J.D. Salinger called Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut. Wait just a second. Eloise raised her head and her voice. Is that you, Ramona? Yes, a small child's voice answered. Close the front door after you, please, Eloise called. Is that Ramona? Oh, I'm dying to see her. Do you realize I haven't seen her since she had her? Ramona, Eloise shouted, with her eyes shut. Go out in the kitchen and let Grace take your galoshes off. All right, said Ramona. Come on, Jimmy. Oh, I'm dying to see her, Mary Jane said. Oh, God, look what I did. I'm terribly sorry, El. Leave it, said Eloise. I hate this damn rug anyway. I'll get you another. No, look, I have more than half left. Mary Jane held up her glass. Sure, said Eloise. Give me a cigarette. Mary Jane extended her pack of cigarettes, saying, Oh, I'm dying to see her. Who does she look like now? Eloise struck a light. Akeem Tamaroff. No, seriously. Lou. She looks like Lou. When his mother comes over, the three of them look like triplets. Without sitting up, Eloise reached for a stack of ashtrays on the far side of the cigarette table. She successfully lifted off the top one and set it down on her stomach. What I need is a cocker spaniel or something, she said. Somebody that looks like me. How are her eyes now? Mary Jane asked. I mean, they're not any worse or anything, are they? God, not that I know of. Can she see at all without her glasses? I mean, if she gets up in the night to go to the John or something. She won't tell anybody. She's lousy with secrets. Mary Jane turned around in her chair. Well, hello, Ramona, she said. Oh, what a pretty dress. She set down her drink. I'll bet you don't even remember me, Ramona. Certainly she does. Who's the lady, Ramona? Mary Jane, said Ramona and scratched herself. Marvelous, said Mary Jane. Ramona, will you give me a little kiss? Stop that, Eloise said to Ramona. Ramona stopped scratching herself. Will you give me a little kiss, Ramona? Mary Jane asked again. I don't like to kiss people. Eloise snorted and asked, Where's Jimmy? He's here. Who's Jimmy? Mary Jane asked Eloise. Oh, God, her beau. Goes where she goes, does what she does, all very hoopla. Really? Said Mary Jane enthusiastically. She leaned forward. Do you have a beau, Ramona? Ramona's eyes, behind thick counter-myopia glasses, did not reflect even the smallest part of Mary Jane's enthusiasm. Mary Jane asked you a question, Ramona, Eloise said. Ramona inserted a finger into her small, broad nose. Stop that, Eloise said. Mary Jane asked you if you have a beau. Oh, yes, said Ramona, busy with her nose. Ramona, Eloise said, cut that out, but immediately. Ramona put her hand down. Well, I think that's just wonderful, Mary Jane said. What's his name? Will you tell me his name, Ramona, or is it a big secret? Jimmy, Ramona said. Jimmy? Oh, I love the name Jimmy. Jimmy what, Ramona? Jimmy Jimmerino, said Ramona. Stand still, said Eloise. Well, that's quite a name. Where is Jimmy? Will you tell me, Ramona? Here, said Ramona. Mary Jane looked around, then looked back at Ramona, smiling as provocatively as possible. Here where, honey? Here, said Ramona. I'm holding his hand. I don't get it, Mary Jane said to Eloise, who was finishing her drink. Don't look at me, said Eloise. Mary Jane looked back at Ramona. Oh, I see. Jimmy's just a make-believe little boy. Marvelous. Mary Jane leaned forward cordially. How do you do, Jimmy? She said. He won't talk to you, said Eloise. Ramona, tell Mary Jane about Jimmy. Tell her what? Stand up, please. Tell Mary Jane how Jimmy looks. He has green eyes and black hair. What else? No mommy and no daddy. What else? No freckles. What else? A sword. What else? I don't know, said Ramona and began to scratch herself again. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a good spot to stop with the scratch. All right, so had you read this story before, or tell us how you chose it?
So I was thinking about point of view, and I was thinking about J.D. Salinger. When we did Perfect Day for Banana Fish, I'm pretty sure we talked about it on this podcast, but in that story, there's no interior, character interior, no mental like description of what they're thinking or what they're feeling or what's happening inside their head. It's all external, right? It's all
Right.
pure third person. It's like a TV show. You don't get to know anything that's happening inside of them. And I was like, that was so interesting. I wanted to read it again or to read another one of his stories and just like really look at it. But then I was also thinking about something we don't really talk about. We kind of reference it without naming it, and we don't talk about subtext a lot on the podcast. Like we'll talk about stuff that is subtext without saying what it is. But I was like, that kind of point of view is like you have to be a master of subtext to like express anything with that point of view where you get no interiority, because we know the interiority of them, of the characters, by the end of the story. And so I kind of wanted to think about that too. So I just picked the next story in the book. So after Perfect Day for Banana Fish is Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut. So I was like, let's do it.
Well, I read it when you sent it over and I was like, this feels familiar. And then when I read it the second time, I was like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. Because I bought that little nine stories book after
we did
Banana Fish. I bought the book and I started going through it, and it's the second story. And I was like, okay, yes, I have read this before.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard to tell. Like, this is one of those like very distinct stories, I feel like, where it obviously fits with this collection for a lot of reasons, but just the dialogue and the fact that it's pure dialogue.
Yeah.
And the way that these women are talking to each other, where they're revisiting subjects and they're getting interrupted, and then they're having these asides with Ramona
and getting increasingly drunk.
Increasingly drunk. And it's like making, like, you know, they're getting like a little hysterical by the end, and they're canceling work, and it all feels like really real and authentic.
Oh, and the diction, like everything is so well done. Yeah.
It's just, it's so like specific. I was embarrassed that I couldn't remember where I'd read it, but I was like, I remember this. I remember this. Like, that says something. There's stories like that we've done on the podcast where if I reread them, it would maybe take me longer, you know, because it's been a while. But this was one of those ones I was like, wait a second. No, it's distinct enough.
There's one thing about the dialogue. I think in the PDF, I looked all over and I could not find a PDF that preserved the italics. Like a lot of the way the dialogue uses italics for emphasis, like the word in the sentence that the character is emphasizing.
Yeah. I see it.
And the PDF doesn't do that. And I was like, it's fine. You can read it without it. But I do think that does lend something to the way the sentences come out, the way they're being spoken.
Yeah, I'm looking at a couple here in the book right now. And like, you could almost, if you had the task of like italicizing something in the PDF version, you might pick the right words, but you might not say it that way when you're reading it. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of have the idea where the emphasis would go, but you're right. It does like make that character a little more like alive. Well, this is changing subjects, but in the section that you just read, I'm glad you read it, because I don't know that I would have gone back through my notes on this copy and found it. But I loved how once you got into the rhythm of this story, because I do think it takes a little bit you realize that these women are like interrupting each other and they're bringing up people that they know that we have no concept of, and names and little anecdotes that clearly they've revisited multiple times over the years. Like, they're just, we're basically eavesdropping, right?
Yeah, and they were college roommates. So it's like, remember that time in our first year? Right.
I think this piece in particular, like when it comes to dialogue, there would be a million pitfalls where you could slip into the maid and butler speak, but because they don't, that's what makes it feel authentic, and that's what makes it feel like we're eavesdropping.
That's part of it.
At no point are they giving the reader any kind of like background. So once you kind of like get your foothold though and realize how this is going and what the cadence and rhythm and everything is, like, it's pretty seamless, I think. But in the section that you read, there's this part where it says Mary Jane's talking. She's like, oh, I'm dying to see her. Mary Jane said, oh God, look what I did. I'm terribly sorry, Elle. And then Eloise says, leave it. I hate this damn rug anyway. I'll get you another.
Yeah.
And so there's no prose in between telling you that she spilled her drink, but you know exactly what happened. And I underlined that section and I was like, this is so well done. Like, there's so many examples I can think of in anything I've read or written where I would have just explained what happened then.
Yeah.
And instead, the dialogue is just doing it for us, and it adds this like extra layer. I don't think you should show all action through dialogue this way, but this was just seamless.
There's so many times in the workshop where I will mark a passage like that and say, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious if J.D. Salinger was in our workshop, would I have done that in that moment? Because it does work in that moment.
Because they articulate something.
Yes.
Right afterwards, it says, Mary Jane extended her pack of cigarettes saying, oh, I'm dying to see her. Who does she look like now? He could have easily made that say like, oh, I'm dying to see her. Here, take one of my cigarettes. Who does she look like now? You know what I mean? He could do it every single time.
Yes. It's this is what I was talking about. He's like a master of subtext, right?
Yeah.
Like, because the whole story, the surface of the story is not the story. Like, this conversation isn't the story. It's what's happening underneath. It's subtext. It's the story is. And so those moments are like, kind of like, you know, I spilled a drink on the rug isn't really subtext, but it's subtextual, right? It's like not stated. You have to infer it. And the same thing you have have to do in order to understand the main story. So I think it's like almost like signposting, like this is how you have to read the story.
Right.
You can't just look at what's being said. You have to pay attention to what's behind it.
Yeah. And like you said, it's like hard to know like why and when he chooses to do some of these things that way.
Well, it's like natural, right? Like you spill a drink, like the reaction
you apologize, yeah,
is enough for it. Whereas yeah, like she doesn't have to say, here, take a cigarette.
Yeah, she just does.
She's just going to stick her arm out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So to that end, it might be hard to mimic this style unless you are aiming to be fully dialogue or like with long stretches of dialogue where things like this are actually going on. You might not have like a natural opportunity to do this, but when it works, it's cool.
Yeah, the right story it could work for. One of the things, like because it's third person, like strictly third person, like we're not getting like inner speech, we're not getting thoughts represented or even like emotions, like, you know, Mary Jane felt a burning anger start to build in her. There's no like reports of anything interior happening.
Right.
All of the interiority is underneath. So the point I was going to get to, I lost track of it, was the thoughts come out when you're talking, like what you're thinking usually spills out of your mouth as you're talking, because it's like basically you're expressing your thoughts when you speak. So that's one way that in the third person is strictly like exterior representation, you can get a little bit of interiority. And so figuring out what things a character is going to say to express something and what they're going to express through action, like reaching out with the cigarettes versus saying, have a cigarette. I'm sure she made a big motion when she dropped the drink. There was some action associated with that, but we don't need to see that because the words express it. The, what she says expresses it.
Right.
And she specifically said, oh God. And the God is italicized. Look what I did. I'm terribly sorry. And leave it, said Eloise. Like she has to say it twice. She emphasizes it the second time, which indicates that Mary Jane is not leaving it the first time. She's doing something. She's probably trying to dab at it or something. But, you know, the subtext of the subtext, like the reaction itself is like part of describing the kind of person Eloise is. We're getting a glimpse of her interiority just by the way she's reacting to this.
I really like the section that you read too with Ramona. She feels like a real child. She's like scratching herself and picking her nose.
Picking her nose.
And it just seems so authentic, you know? I feel like a lot of times when you see kids, especially like in movies, they're just terrible actors. And some of the shit they say is like so precocious and like, I wish we would not use children as these conduits for saying like wise things, right?
Oh yeah.
And we do that a lot, even in prose, even in writing and stuff. But Ramona is just like a foil in a lot of ways. And she's just herself. And just by being herself and by being like a real kid, we get to see what her mother is like as a mother and to like draw parallels with these little imaginary friends, right?
Yeah. And she looks just like her husband. So she's like a stand-in because he's not in the scene. Like she can be almost a stand-in for that. And she's not as like her husband doesn't seem very bright. The girl's not very bright. And Eloise is very frustrated with it all.
Yeah.
Very much like, this isn't the life I signed up for.
No, I like the part that you read where Mary Jane's like, what's going on with this friend? And Eloise is like, I don't know. Yeah, you tell me. I have no clue. Jimmy Jimmerino, Mickey Mickaroo, or whatever she names the next one. Her imaginary friend Jimmy literally gets run over by a car during this story. And she just comes back into the house and she's like, nah, listen, I got another guy. He's gone.
Well, I mean, part of that is like, okay, Jimmy's gone. But now she's going to sleep all the way on the other side of the bed for just the next guy. And her mom is like, no, that's what made me unhappy. I just went to the next guy. Because Mary Jane, I think they married very briefly before he died. Her husband died and she did not get remarried.
Okay.
So Mary Jane is kind of like a, like Eloise looks at her as like, I guess I didn't have to get remarried or I didn't have to move on to the next guy. So she's really frustrated when Ramona is like, well, Jimmy died outside, but I'm still going to make room for the new guy, Mickey.
Yeah. And
she's
her
like,
bed.
No, no, no. Sleep in the middle. Sleep in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's not conscious. This is why it's subtext, right? It's not conscious, but that is like going to precipitate a reaction because it represents that kind of.
Yeah. She's obviously going through it and she's got a friend that's like just as drunk. It's like, it's such a shame that it's never spoken, but that's what makes this powerful, right? Like we get to see what it's like for a character to have all of this going on and to your point, maybe not even realize it. So they don't articulate it either way. And that's what makes it like such a rich story.
Yeah.
This is what fiction does, is let us see how what people are dealing with when they don't even know what they're dealing with.
Yeah. I think subtext is such a, that's why I wanted to bring in a story like this in, like thinking about subtext, is because so much story happens there. And that's like a lot of where the real power of story comes from. It's also, I think, when you have like, you want to read literary criticism, you're like, well, what does it all mean? You're not actually saying, you know, that's like phrasing the question wrong. The question is, what's the subtext? What's the like, what's going on underneath? One thing, can I dramatically change the subject?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing that I kept.
No.
Well, I didn't know if we were done with that section.
Oh, yeah. No, you're good.
So I mentioned at the beginning that Banana Fish and this story are both this like hyper third person. We get no dips into the consciousness of any of the characters, right? But there are little moments here and there where we almost do. And I was marking them as we went. Like Eloise is explaining about Jimmy and she's like saying that Jimmy and Ramona, and like Ramona sleeps way over to one side of the bed. She's not to roll over and hurt him. And then this is the description of Mary Jane. Looking absorbed and delighted with this information, Mary Jane took in her lower lip, then released it to ask, where do you get that name, though? So this looking absorbed and delighted with this information is almost a glimpse inside. It's like you're reading a facial expression and you're kind of projecting what's happening behind it, what's causing that absorption. And then there's another moment a couple pages later. It's like Eloise paused to drink from her glass and to think. That's actually reporting what's happening in her head. We don't get a lot of like, and then she thought about this, or she contemplated her place in life or whatever.
Right.
But just to announce that she's paused to think, it's not what she's thinking about. But this is, again, you can kind of write it off as that's what she looks like from the outside. She looks like she's. And so for most of those little moments, you know, Mary Jane stood up, losing and recovering her balance, and left the room. In a different context, that would be an interior thought. Like, I'm Mary Jane and I'm experiencing losing my balance and recovering it. But in this context, she looks like she's losing her balance and recovering it. He's describing a stumble, basically. Ramona ran as flat-footed as possible, trying to get the maximum noise out of her open galoshes. We don't know if she's literally trying, like in her head, thinking to herself, I want to get the maximum noise out of my galoshes, or if that's just the effect that we're seeing, is like she seems to be trying to get the maximum amount. So those are like moments where you can read it both ways. You can read it as a report of what's going on inside, or just a third person description of what it looks like from the outside, which I just find endlessly fascinating, like that third person remove.
Yeah.
But there is one moment that I noticed, and there might be more. This is just when I read it, I marked this, where Mary Jane, looking depressed. So this is a third person, like she looks depressed. We don't know if she really is, but she looks depressed. Looking depressed, raised her chin from the armrest of the couch. For a change, she supported her chin on her forearm. She thought over Eloise's advice. You can't call Lou not intelligent, she said aloud. So now we have not merely what's happening in her head. She's not merely thinking. She's thinking about something. And that's more interior. Like knowing what the object of her rumination is more interior than mere third person, what it looks like from the outside.
Right.
You can write it off as that's what it looks like because Eloise just said something. She seems to be pondering it. So that's like a third person visual. But it is pretty interior. And that seems to be, to me, my reading, the only moment where that happens. So I'm not pointing this out to say it's a mistake or something. It's just like when we describe something from the outside, like pure third person point of view, like the way we look at people, the way we think about people is so, we so reflexively attribute mental states to people, animals.
Yeah, sure.
Cars, even. Like that car looks angry, right?
Yeah.
But it's a car. That's not really angry. But you can describe someone as like, she looked angry, or you can just say she was angry. And both of those are just descriptions of what they look like in the third person. So it's something to, when you're writing, to think about whatever your point of view is, you can attribute mental states to characters from an outside perspective as a description. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So that it doesn't become this like necessarily like some third person omniscient or first person. Yeah.
You're not necessarily diving into their thoughts, but you're still telling the reader, showing the reader what they're thinking about or what they see, what seems to be going on inside.
Well, it's the same way, like if a character was going to have a certain facial expression in a film, but not say anything, that you would linger on that facial expression. Like the camera would switch over.
The reaction shot.
Yeah. And show you that somebody had a look on their face that was like disgust or like suspicion or whatever it is. They don't have to say a single word, but we're paying attention to that because it says so much about what they're thinking.
Yeah. We're wired to see that. Like that's why close-ups on actors work, is because we're wired to read facial expressions and understand understand them in a very specific, concrete way.
There was a story that we read recently in a workshop where the writer was like accidentally head hopping and was aware of it, but it was something like that this writer struggled with a lot, it sounds like. And this is a good solution, right? Where you still need to commit to having a main character whose thoughts we know, because otherwise, like, I don't know, I'm not like, nobody's interested in reading like this third person omniscient thing where we know what everyone's thinking at every point in time, unless the point of that is to see these characters like repeatedly misunderstand each other.
Yeah. I read a story a couple years ago where I was like, after a couple of drafts, I realized I need to be in both of their heads.
Yeah. Sometimes
so you can
works.
See the dynamics, right?
And sometimes it's completely necessary, but like to your point, maybe it's only necessary when that's the entire point.
That's
otherwise,
the point. Yeah.
Otherwise it's like completely like jarring and confusing and it doesn't make sense, but this is a good solution. And also in this story, I think it's pretty clear, if not from the jump, eventually that like Eloise is our character.
It seems to be what the story is kind of showing us her. Like Mary Jane is more of a vehicle for showing that. I mean, it's a little bit about her too. It's a little bit all of them, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're all like pretty prominently featured. I mean, aside from like the maid or whatever and like the husband, but we know it's not Ramona's story.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, whose is it? And I think like it's obviously clear because by the end, Eloise is the only one still awake.
That's right.
You know what I mean? I mean, like if Mary Jane went to bed and this was her story, we would pick up where she's being woken up by Eloise.
Yeah. But there are moments in the story where
yeah.
Eloise isn't there. It's like a camera. The camera's just looking in a room. And I think when Eloise goes upstairs, I don't think Mary Jane follows her. And she's like wrestling with Ramona to get
oh,
her to
yeah,
sit.
Oh, yeah. Putting her to bed. Yeah. Because I think when she comes back down, Mary Jane's passed out on the couch and she has to like shake her awake and be like, was I a good person?
Yes. That's the crisis moment, right? So the crisis moment of the story is focused on Eloise. So it seems to be Eloise's story.
Well, I feel like I have like a couple things that I'll remember from the story as like takeaways, and they're all things that you said first. So I'll let you give your takeaway first.
Well, my takeaway, and I think I knew what my takeaway was going to be before I even picked the story, because I've been thinking about subtext, but is just to think about subtext. Like, how do you tell a bigger story than what's on the page? We talked like one of the first episodes talking about dialogue where characters aren't hearing each other, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just little things like that. Like where the crosstalk, dialogue can do it. Character description can do it. This whole story does it. Just how you present something that's not on the page, but is the main story or becomes part of the main story or supports the main story, or otherwise just plays into it. I think that is one of those places. Like I said at the beginning, we don't name it often enough, but I think it is a hugely important part of making good fiction.
Yeah. Not just the fact that it's not said, but that like, that's still what we're talking about.
Yes.
What's not said is the focus. It's the point.
Yeah. It's the subject matter.
Yeah. So when I read this, my only takeaways were focusing on dialogue and what's done well here. And I just really like how, like I said early on, that there's not this info dump at any point. We don't ever get this like background story. And after I like picked up the 9 stories, I like just read the next one in the book.
That was going to be my next one that I brought of his. Like,
oh, really?
You can do it first.
Well, whatever works. But like the next story, I just started reading it. And this whole collection of stories, like they're supposedly somehow related because the characters like know each other. But at least by the third one, you're not like totally conscious of that. You feel like you're being dropped in at every point. And at no point in any of these is there like this massive, massive info dump. Like, but anyway, in this story, Uncle Wiggily, I like how we don't get that. And they're just talking to each other the way they would talk to each other. And that is what makes dialogue authentic. And you might be a little confused as the reader, but just keep going. Obviously,
that's where subtext comes in, right?
Yeah, like you have to like pay attention and read into it.
Yeah, you have to write it in such a way that the information's there if you dig for it. Humans are meant to do that. We're meant, like,
yes.
When you look at a face, you know what they're feeling,
right? And when you listen to what they're saying, you're also thinking to yourself, like, are they lying to me? Is that how they really feel? Is that how it really? You know what I mean? Like, you're aware of all these things. So yeah, like give your reader a little more credit
and give them the clues that are necessary, but not too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line, I guess, is the point. And there are definitely cases where you read dialogue in a workshop setting and you're like, what are they talking about? But you can tell it's the fault of the reader or the writer, because it's not, subtext is not what's at play. So this is like an interesting little balancing act. But I just appreciate dialogue that feels really authentic that way. And that's one way to do it.
All right, so Uncle Wiggily, okay?
Yeah.
I remember as a kid, I played this board game.
And John's the point, 75.
The point was you have to help Uncle Wiggily get to his doctor.
Uncle Wiggily's a rabbit.
He's a rabbit and he has rheumatoid, the rheumatism. He's got the rheumatism. rheumatism and he needs his medication. So you got to get to the doctor. So you draw cards and it tells you to hop ahead five spaces or whatever. And then when you get to the doctor, he gets his medicine. But he's, you know, he limps because he's got the rheumatism. He's got rheumatoid arthritis.
That poor guy.
Poor rabbit. Poor bunny. And there's all kinds of things in the woods that are like, stay away from the creatures.
What a bizarre concept for a children's game.
That's why when she banged her or hurt her ankle and he joked and called her Uncle Wiggly because she was limping.
It all makes sense.
It all makes sense.
All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/NaplesWritersWorkshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.